is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, July 2nd. Filling in for Buster today, I'm Keith Law. Our producer is Troy Farkas. Before we get into the show, there was breaking news in the world of baseball yesterday afternoon. Police found Angels pitcher Tyler Skaggs dead in his hotel room in Texas. He was 27. The Angels issued a statement. It is with great sorrow that we report Tyler Skaggs passed away earlier today in Texas. Tyler has and always will be an important part of the Angels family. Our thoughts and prayers are with his wife, Carly, and his entire family during this devastating time. Our own Tim Kirkjian was on SportsCenter last night and offered this remembrance of Tyler Skaggs.
It's devastating news, obviously, for the Skaggs family and to the Angels, but for all of baseball. And they're all a family here. They all know what everyone is going through. And to lose a player in the prime of his career like this was just gut-wrenching for everybody here. I'm not sure how the Angels are going to get through this because this was such a nice kid. If you knew Tyler Skaggs, it's impossible not to like him. And now they're going to have to go on and figure out how to get through the rest of the season. And don't forget, they've had tragedy before with the Angels 10 years ago. Nick Adenhart died in a car crash. And believe me, it took the Angels organization a long time to get through that.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned how nice he was, because after individual tragedies like these, people always speak in such glowing terms of the individual that's just passed. And if you read between the lines, it really does sound like he was a nice young man who went out of his way for others. I'm just curious what else. Sounds like, you know, he battled some injuries, I know that, but he made a career high in starts a season ago, had a pretty nice season this year. What else can you tell us about this young man?
Well, he's been through an awful lot injury-wise, as you said, Steve. And, you know, he's the Southern California kid. He played for the Diamondbacks. He got back basically to home with the Angels. This is where I know he had hoped to spend the rest of his career, and to have it end short like this. Again, this is just devastating news for all of baseball. And I know the Cubs and the Pirates, the game I did tonight, all the players severely affected by this. And how couldn't they be?
That's our own Tim Kirkjian speaking with Steve Levy on SportsCenter last night about the passing of Tyler Skaggs. I only barely knew Tyler myself. I'd spoken to him maybe twice during his professional career. Did scout him many times going back to high school, but that all feels really immaterial at this point. And what I tend to find myself doing in situations like this, there are always certain pieces of literature, especially of poetry, that I go back to when someone who maybe I wasn't particularly close to dies, but I still sort of find myself feeling really affected by it because I'd seen, just physically seen Tyler so many times. From John Donne's very famous poem, For Whom the Bell Tolls, "No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." Well, I feel like the timing is absolutely perfect for our next guest. Dr. Meredith Wills is a sports data scientist with a previous career in astrophysics. She's done a lot of independent research on player tracking. She's also written multiple pieces now as a contributor to The Athletic, three pieces over the last year and a half, looking at what's going on with the baseball. So, Meredith, let me start with this question. What do you say to people who claim or say state that the baseball is juiced?
Oh, man. I guess I'm not going to go into the technicality of people saying what juiced is or not, because there is sort of a technical term to it, which, or some people care, whatever. The main thing that I think of when I think of juiced is intentional change. I am not sure, or more to the point, I can't speak to the idea that this was a premeditated change on MLB's part. There are absolutely ways to understand it that just have to do with process improvements and improved quality control and that sort of thing. So if anybody does want to look into the, you know, reasons behind why the changes occurred, that's fine, but that's also not the point of what I've been doing.
So you've got a recent piece, let's see, June 25th. Yes, the baseball is different again. An astrophysicist examines this year's baseballs and breaks down the changes. Now, you've written, like I said, these three pieces, and the changes you found to the baseball, what you found in 2018 is not the same as what you found in 2019. So let's talk about the most recent piece first. What exactly is going on with the baseball now, and how does that tie into these record-setting home run paces we're seeing across the game?
Well, the ball is, as the title says, the ball is different. And when I say different, I mean it is unlike anything. Certainly, my study goes back as far, at least it looks like as far as around 2000. And all of those balls, for the most part, seem to be the same. It's hard to find differences in terms of things like roundness or leather smoothness. There's some differences. But this ball is very different from all of them in multiple ways. All of and any one of those changes would make the ball travel further. The three big ones that we're seeing are that the seams are lower, as in like half the height, which is unlike anything we've seen. The ball is rounder, and then the leather is also smoother. And again, all of these are meaningful changes. These are not trends. And that alone says a lot, because for most of the things we've seen before, it's only been trends, if there's been anything. There's only one change I found before, so, and even that one was would not have been caught had you sort of not been looking.
And what kind of reaction have you gotten from Major League Baseball to the things you've published over the last year plus, pointing out these changes? Because for listeners who haven't really followed the story, Major League Baseball has been fairly reluctant to admit that there are physical differences in the baseball that would explain all or part of this home run surge. So how have they reacted to what you've said?
The closest I've had to a reaction was before the first piece came out, and this was just showing a physical change. It had to do with lace thickness. This was for the ball associated with the 2017 home run surge, that I did reach out both to the home run committee and to the front office, or excuse me, not the front office, the commissioner's office, for statements. Dr. Alan Nathan, who's the chair of the home run committee, did actually give me a statement. The commissioner's office, when they found that Dr. Nathan had actually provided me with some kind of reaction, said that's our official MLB response. After that, I did have a small meeting with a couple people from the home run committee who were interested in process and very interested in how one makes laces, which was sort of it wasn't the direction I expected that to go. And then other than one or two private conversations with Dr. Nathan, that's the closest I've had to any response from MLB. So there's been nothing from the commissioner's office except we said what they said back in, about over a year ago.
Right. That was May of 2018 was when their report came out.
June of 2000. It was okay. Quite literally D-Day. My dropped on D-Day.
Okay. So you were just a matter of a few weeks after their report came out. Because I remember Alan Nathan, Dr. Nathan being on they did a conference call for the media. So you were about 3 weeks after that, your piece came out.
MLB dropped the news that they had bought Rawlings, which was a total fluke.
Oh.
So the 5th they announced the purchase of Rawlings, the 6th my article came out.
So now getting back to the changes in the baseball this year, and I mean, obviously I've read all of your work on this, but it seems like one that I would love for you to explain why these changes are resulting in baseballs going farther, why this specifically is leading to these crazy home run totals. And two, also, I know you've written quite a bit about changes to the baseball affecting pitchers specifically. So can you talk about those two things? Just start with the home run stuff, and then let's talk about why this actually matters to pitchers beyond just bloated ERAs.
Okay. Well, ultimately, the reason that the ball is going to travel further is it's it's more aerodynamic. The way you describe it is it has less drag to it. And so in this case, that kind of relates to sort of how the ball is traveling through the air, particularly kind of think of it as like turbulence around the ball. And so things like the seam height, the higher the seams, the more the more drag you're going to get. One way to think about it would be the closer the ball is to a cue ball, the more easily it's going to travel through the air. You know, perfectly round will travel as well as it can, and very, very smooth. So by having lower seams, you get it closer to a cue ball. By having smoother leather also, and then the fact that the ball is, I mean, it's, you know, except for the seams, it basically seems to be almost perfectly round, which was really surprising to me, because before there was always a little bit of deformation near the seams, and this time it's just not there. As far as effects on pitchers, this one in some ways is actually better for pitchers. The previous ball, and this turned out to be related to the home run surge as well, was that, by the way, I guess I should specify, when I say previous ball, I mean the one that was introduced in the middle of 2015 and went through 2018. So this is the ball associated with the 2017 home run surge. If we go before that, that's sort of, think of it as Bud Selig's tenure. Those balls are his thing. So there's three populations. But the previous ball, the 2017 one, had thicker laces, which was leading to pitcher blister problems, really serious pitcher blister problems. Ben Lindbergh published a great article on this. And the new ball has actually gone back to the thinner laces from, say, the Bud Selig tenure. So the reason that we haven't been hearing much about, you know, the pitchers who kept going on the DL for, you know, long enough periods is just because the pitchers who are having or used to have the seam-related blister injuries, it's not happening. Now, that being said, there are guys who are getting blisters. Not a lot have gone on the DL, but, you know, there was one major league pitcher I spoke to, and what's happening is there are guys getting blisters, but they're people who've never gotten blisters before in their lives. And when they are getting blisters, it has much more to do with issues with gripping the ball because the leather is so smooth and the seams are so low. So, you know, they'll say dig their fingernails in, and then the blisters they're getting are the kind when your fingernail kind of tears away from your finger. We've all had that. It's terribly painful because they are digging their fingernails into the ball, and then when they let go, you know, it pulls away at the fingernail. So it's not that they're not happening. They're happening to a different population, and they're happening in between outings. So that's why we're seeing fewer, sorry, IL stints. I shouldn't have said DL. I apologize. But, yeah, so that's what's going on right now with pitchers. And command and control has definitely been an issue, certainly earlier in the season. There has been, and I think you spoke to this a bit in a previous Baseball Tonight podcast, that the ball just isn't breaking as well. And so things like early in the season, walks were up, hit by pitches were up, wild pitches were up. And while the first two you can kind of look at as being on purpose, no pitcher throws a wild pitch on purpose. So if those are up, that's just, there's probably a control problem. I don't think any pitchers throw wild pitches on purpose. I have
probably not. I don't know. Yes.
So, there's probably a reason.
Yeah, there's a Rick Vaughn Major League joke in there somewhere, but we'll probably...
I'm sure there is. Yeah. Oh, no, yes. Actually, you know what? It's the Bull Durham. Throw it at the bull. You don't want to do
Oh,
that.
Yes. Yes.
So there is one sample in Hollywood.
Yes, and of one.
Why a wild pitch is a good idea. Yes.
Now, you just went into a little bit about the mid-2015 through 2018 baseball. Can you get a little more specific with that? Especially, and I bring it up again, too, because the panel led by Dr. Nathan didn't mention the laces, essentially their other conclusions were, and Rob Manfred loved to keep saying, they were within specified tolerances, manufacturing tolerances. But Manfred said at multiple points last year that, yeah, the baseball might be different, but because this is a product that involves at least some human labor to produce it, there are going to be some natural variations among the baseballs. But what you found was actually a more fundamental manufacturing difference. And so can you explain that in a little more depth and why that produced a different home run surge than the home run surge we're experiencing this season?
Yeah, I guess, and this is a bit of a spoiler for the new one, the 2017 home run surge was supply related, as opposed to this new one is process related, although technically what the commissioner is saying is true. It's what do you mean by specifications, I suppose. But so for the previous home run surge, it looks like they just literally changed their primary laces supplier. And when I say thicker laces, it's 9%, which again, meaningful change, but they're already pretty thin. So we're talking about something like from 0.75 millimeters to 0.82 or something. That's a, by eye, most people aren't going to notice that. Even by feel, the people making the ball probably noticed, but I've since gone back and looked, and it looks to me in, you know, for some of the older balls that the lace thickness does go up and down a bit. So that supplier change is probably not atypical. So in that case, it was here we have something different that's being made outside of Rawlings factory that we're just bringing in. I mean, it would be like if they were using different cows for the leather and somehow that had an effect. That's not really the best analogy, but the point being, it's not something that Rawlings is doing internally. And so that ended up, the effect that it had was those thicker laces kept the ball rounder. And like I said, a rounder baseball will travel further. And just that one change does seem to have been associated. So the fact that this ball is even rounder then makes it, you know, makes it, of course you would expect more home runs, you know, and when that's only one change and you've got multiple ones, it's no surprise that we're getting as many as we are.
Do you like, this is more of a subjective question, but the Major League Baseball also started to use the Major League balls at the AAA level this year, which I think that I at least understand the thinking, right? Let's get players, pitchers in particular, used to using the Major League ball at AAA. Because I had young Major League pitchers who came up in 15 and 16 say they found it a difficult adjustment to make to go from using the minor league ball to the Major League ball because it was so different. What do you think of the idea of using, what do you think of the idea of using a different baseball at certain levels in the minors and then a different baseball in the majors from AAA in the majors? Because it always seemed sort of strange to me that we wouldn't be using the same product.
Well, I'll tell you the idea I'm all for. And in fact, you may be able to speak to this better than I can, but my understanding again from a friend who works with the team is that there are some clubs who will use the major league ball all the way down for precisely that reason in their home ballparks. But so the idea is good. The only issue that I have with not putting the ball in AAA, but they're putting this ball in AAA, is that it's now impossible to compare offensive numbers. I mean, it's not even just a trend. It's impossible to compare offensive numbers as far as home runs. Such that if you have a guy where you're looking to see, all right, is he ready for the majors or not, whatever metric you used to use, you now have to come up with a completely different way to evaluate them. And assuming the ball doesn't change again, we will come up with an adjustment. But at least for the guys right now, I think that puts them at a disadvantage.
Yes, I mean, that's actually ties in well to the last question I wanted to ask you, which is essentially what would you say to fans who look at this? We may be enjoying the home run surge, but it's essentially, so what do I think? What do I think of Pete Alonso potentially setting the rookie home run record? He's on pace for more than 52, which is the current rookie home run record. And what was set after when Aaron Judge broke that record, the previous record was set in 1987, which you're close to my age. You remember that was the rabbit ball year. Yep. It was a 1 year outlier. It still sticks out like sore thumb if you look at any kind of statistical history. Do you, I mean, are we, is that what this is? Do you think this is a 1987 type of occurrence? If so, with changes, small changes to the baseball, will we just sort of go back to the way we were 3 years ago and think of 2019, sorry, as just another outlier?
That's actually a tough question. This could be, but so far what it looks like is that Rawlings has quite literally, I mean, I won't say perfected the baseball, but they have figured out a way to, quote, make a better baseball. You know, there are issues that I think some of my work in September pointed out that they might have seen as flaws in the process that it looks like they fixed. And so if you want to go back, do you go to Rawlings and say, yeah, you know, it's great that you've perfected the baseball, now make it worse again? I'm not really sure. Is that the approach we want to take? And then the thing that I guess I've been thinking a lot lately is the game's changed before. We've had eras. I mean, we refer to eras in the game. Mm-hmm. And so if this is the start of a new era, that's okay. But again, it's something that it would be nice if people got on board with and were prepared for. Whatever happens with the game, that's fine. You know, if we keep the home runs, you know, it's great for hitters. It's going to affect pitcher numbers. And so, you know, if we're doing like Hall of Fame considerations in however many years, we're going to have to absolutely consider dichotomies for things like, you know, FIP or whatever for pitchers, in that, you know, you just can't have a small area. Most of the guys won't, because it's not possible, because the ball, you know, routine fly balls are now home runs. And that's almost something you take into account for FIP. Mm-hmm. You know, here, come up with an HR FIP or something. There you go. Here's a challenge for you. So.
Yep. So listeners who want to read more of Meredith's work, you can find her on The Athletic. She's got three separate pieces. I will post the link that gets you directly to her author page there, so you can see all three at once. You can also find Meredith on Twitter. It's BBL_astrophysics without the I, right? So A-S-T-R-O-P-H-Y-S-C-S. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did. That's what I get for setting up the handle back when there were character limits.
Right? Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. It is not fair that they changed that on you. Well, Meredith, thank you so much for joining me. This was really informative.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
Before we hear from Rob Manfred, a quick word from SeatGeek, the ticket buying service that actually cares. With millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek proves there's a better way. Search sports, live music, comedy, and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. Why is SeatGeek better than the rest? A quick look at the App Store shows over 50,000 five-star reviews. How's that for customer satisfaction? It's a better process. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web. Then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. Finally, SeatGeek displays them on an interactive seat map. SeatGeek breaks down the details. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots are overpriced. And every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence. Troy, I know you've used SeatGeek before. What's your experience?
Yeah, Keith, I'm a huge fan of it. I go to a bunch of concerts, especially in the summer, and a lot of games. And I remember I've gone to Mumford & Sons concerts, Dave Matthews Band concerts at my beloved Saratoga Performing Arts Center in upstate New York. And I know, because I've listened to a lot of podcasts like this one that advertise SeatGeek, and people like Buster Olney who know and trust it, I use it too. So it's a great app. It's really user-friendly, so I strongly recommend that you guys use it.
SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you need to do is use our promo code. Download the SeatGeek app today and use the promo code BUSTER for $10 off on your first purchase. That's BUSTER. Now, back to the show. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred spoke with our ESPN radio crew of Boog Sciambi and Chris Singleton on Sunday morning during Game 2 of the London Series between the Yankees and Red Sox. Just a reminder, this conversation took place after a wild Game 1 where the two teams combined to score 30 runs. Now here's Rob Manfred.
Delighted to be joined by the Commissioner of Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred, as well. Mr. Commissioner, Long day of baseball yesterday, but there's been a buzz in the town, in the stadium. What's your take? How have you enjoyed it?
We're absolutely thrilled with the way the two games have played out. The clubs have enjoyed it. The players enjoyed it. Most importantly, you know, you look around, 60,000 fans are enjoying it. It's really good.
I know the Yankees are enjoying it.
Yeah, there's no question the Yankees enjoyed yesterday. I think for the, you know, for the folks that are just getting a taste of baseball, I introduced you to a couple of friends.
Right.
They loved yesterday.
Right. You know, I think that yesterday was a different game, obviously, not the game that we ordinarily think we're going to see. But there was tons of action. Actually, a lot of base hits. I mean, it was 6 home runs, which isn't all that unusual.
Yep.
So I think it was a good game for the fans. And as evidenced by the fact, people stayed. I stayed right to the end. And, you know, there are a lot of people in this stadium at the end of the game.
Commissioner, there's so many people involved in making this happen. And I'm sure there are a lot of things that you've learned that maybe you weren't, you know, expecting to. What's one of the things that sticks out for you and what you've learned in this process of bringing baseball over here?
Well, I think one thing that has really been interesting for us is how much demand already exists for Major League Baseball merchandise and club logoed merchandise. It's kind of a fashion demand. About 30% of what we sell outside the U.S. we sell in Europe as a fashion brand. You know, the trick for us is associating that fashion brand with these great players. And that's been a really interesting process for us.
You know, to that point, I took the train over today and I was walking from the mall. And when I got to a certain point, there was a line that looked like it was, I'm going to say, 250, 300 feet. And I don't, it was the first time I'd come in that way. And I stopped one of the security people. I said, do I have to stand in this line to get in the ballpark? And they said, no, go to the right. This is for merchandise.
Right.
I was blown away.
That line that you saw today, I was over there earlier myself, was the same last night after the game. People waiting to buy merch. And look, that's great for us because we're going to leave. You know, we're leaving, and you want a piece of Major League Baseball walking around on the streets, reminding people how much fun they had, and get them looking forward to next year when we'll be back.
Tell me a little bit about the way this field was put together. I mean, it plays fast. People talked about the dimensions. I didn't feel like that factored in too much yesterday, but it's a similar surface to what they have in Arizona and we'll have in Texas.
Right. It is a similar surface. The challenge for us was, you know, there's a soccer pitch underneath here. They didn't want us cutting the grass, you can understand. So we put down some drainage and then built artificial turf field on top of it. We actually brought the dirt in from Pennsylvania. We'll be storing that dirt until next year when we'll use it again. It was quite a project, and hats off to Murray Cook, our field expert, and his team. I think the field's really playable. It may not be exactly the same as playing, you know, in Fenway Park or in Yankee Stadium, but really playable.
Could you have a team in London at some point down the line?
Yeah, I think the challenge there is the everyday nature of the game and travel. And but travel's going to get easier. Everything has made our world closer and closer together. As travel improves, I think it is possible.
Oh, so as Christian, I was talking with Tony Petitti, one of your right-hand guys, and talked about, you know, Fort Bragg, Omaha this year, where we've had baseball. We've done it over in Japan, now in London. We know next year that Major League Baseball would be back here, but beyond next year, what are you guys thinking? Is it perhaps a third year here in England, or is there another spot on the globe?
Well, we love London. I mean, we you know, obviously we've had a great experience here. We're looking forward to next year, and I'd like to have a recurring presence in London. Mm-hmm. I'd like to do other cities in Europe as well. I mean, the challenge, obviously, is finding facilities where you can lay out a baseball field. It's not an easy or inexpensive undertaking, but I think it's important for us to be places other than London, again, with the idea that we love coming here and we'll continue to come here.
Tell me a little bit about the way the two teams have enjoyed their time over here, because, I mean, the Yankees had a clinic, a youth clinic, where they had Hideki Matsui, Mariano Rivera, Reggie Jackson, Alex Rodriguez. I mean, it was Andy Pettit. It was incredible.
Well, I was actually at that youth event. You know, hats off to the Yankees. They found a really active baseball club here in London. The best thing about the event was on the way in, there are three baseball fields. There's actually a sign that had been there for a while, obviously, because it was worn, that said, only baseball played here. And, you know, that's a great thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure there's not many of them in London, but the fact that there was one is a good thing. And the Yankees put on a great event. The club actually has four levels of adult baseball and youth baseball from 18U all the way down to T-ball. Really great.
Yeah, one of the things before we let you go as far as that, I know that for you, I've asked you this in the past at an event we were at together a while back. But the play ball opportunities for kids is the thing that really pushes the buttons for you and the thing you enjoy as much as anything.
Yeah, I do love it. But, you know, it's the legacy that you want to leave behind. Again, we'll be back here next year, but in the next 12 months, we hope the youth activations that we did while we're here, the Fun at Bat program that we started in 50 schools, gets a bunch of kids playing the game. And those programs we need to continue to focus on and grow.
What else at home are the things you'll be looking at going forward to help with the game, grow the game, attracting younger fans for the future?
Well, I think that, you know, in a way, this is an example of it. I think you will see us continue to try to eventize our regular season. To have certain, you know, it's not going to be every game,
sure.
But, you know, to make certain games special, yeah. Like Williamsport has become, like I think Omaha was, to tell you the truth. And I think it's a way to capture a generation that's interested in the big event.
Commissioner, one more thing. When we talk about capturing this younger generation attention span, you've talked a lot about pace of play and how that sort of relates to time of game. What can we expect to see perhaps over the next couple of years of further implementation?
Well, what I can tell you about for sure is next year. I do think the change to the 26 and 28-man rosters, getting away from the 40-man roster in September, will really help us. I mean, September, you know, exacerbates some of the issues that we have, and I think that's a good change. I really do think we're going to end up going with the three-batter minimum for relief pitchers next year. We have the right to do it. We made an agreement with the MLBPA about that, and I'm quite confident that at the end of the day we're going to go ahead and do it. I think we're at that point in time where it could be a change that will really help us.
You're open, aren't you? I mean, my sense is that I know you love this sport, but, you know, as a guy that grew up in, I know you're a big, you know, Mickey Mantle guy, and I know that someone that loves this game, but you're also open to making sure that it thrives, and it's a conservative sport, I would say, in part, but you're open to change, aren't you?
Look, I think you have to be open to change in today's world. It's just that everything has changed so much, and a lot of the rule changes we're talking about,
yeah,
actually are designed to get baseball back to the way it was 15 or 20 years ago. You know, the game has changed organically, and we're just trying to manage that change a little bit.
Thank you so much, sir. Appreciate you stopping by.
Great to
see
you.
Great job with all this.
We'll be back in a moment with Sarah Langs, but first, staining your deck this summer again? This time, maybe you should try something that's stain-changing. Introducing Valspar Solid Color Stain. It's easy to apply, all-weather protection that brings so much color and coverage to the party, you can bring out the color of the shutters or the planters or even your eyes. You'll love it, guaranteed, for 10 years. Yeah, that's stain-changing. Valspar Exterior Stain, only at Lowe's. Okay, now back to the show.
Numbers game.
Well, now I am very pleased to introduce my old friend, Sarah Langs, who now works for MLB. MLB.com is a reporter-producer, but of course, Sarah and I, we've done this show many times together in the past. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you, Keith. It's awesome to get the chance to talk to you on here again, for sure.
So I know you were covering Atlanta over the weekend and got a chance to see and talk to Mike Soroka, who I've always found a particularly interesting prospect. One, because he's just exceeded some of the expectations I had for him out of the draft. But also, when he got to the big leagues, he looked very much to me like a different pitcher. I even talked to some of the Atlanta front office guys about how much more life he had, like visible movement on his fastball once he got to the majors. And the Atlanta people actually thought that the Major League Baseball helped him, where we've heard a lot about how it's hurt certain pitchers. They felt that it was particularly helping him. So in your conversations with him and from watching him, what did you see in Soroka that's contributed to him being so effective so far this year?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I feel like I have a special connection with this because I happened to be at his debut. It was just a game
I went to
with my parents last year. And
yeah,
we were, like, aware that someone was making a debut, but maybe not completely aware of it. And we were in great seats. And his family and about 15 Canadian flags. and a bunch of people who painted their chest for K's, for Soroka with K's, were right near us. So I very much am reminded of that. The funny thing about that is that was very raucous. And the thing that struck me most about him, and it shows on the mound and it shows in the locker room and everything, is just how composed he is. And, you know, I talked to Brian Snitker about him, and I talked to pitching coach, and everyone just said he's so businesslike. And I think that, like, it's so impressive to do that, to do what he's doing at age 21, no matter what your composure is, no matter how you handle yourself. But I think that it helps him, and I think that you would think he's a grizzled veteran in a lot of ways. Obviously, he doesn't have a whole lot of experience. He missed a lot of time last year with an injury, and he was very deferential about that when he made the All-Star team. He said that he was just trying to stay healthy this year. You know, that was his main goal. And, you know, sometimes guys say that and, oh, they're just being modest. He wasn't. He really, truly sounded like that's what he meant. And I thought that was really impressive. The other thing that he said that just blew me away was, you know, we're kind of talking to him. Is there someone you're really excited to see in that All-Star locker room? You know, who are you going to be, like, pinching yourself and, you know, who are you going to maybe take a picture with, get an autograph from? And he said he just wants to take it all in with his eyes. He doesn't want camera. He doesn't want memories and pictures. He just wants to remember it for being there. And I'm 26 years old, and I need a picture of everything I do. And he's 21, and he doesn't. And I was just completely blown away by that. And I think that, you know, it's really, really great for the Braves to have his talent, but also, I mean, he's going to be a leader. You know, they have Freddie Freeman. They don't necessarily need him to be yet, but to have guys like that in the clubhouse is so important. And to have one who's 21 and already like this is just outstanding for them.
So the MLB Futures game is coming up on Sunday. We've actually already had one change that I've seen to the roster. Brendan McKay, since he's in the big leagues, now out of the game, he's going to be replaced by Kansas City lefty Chris Bubich. Well, one of the stars of last year's Futures game, Fernando Tatis Jr., has now become one of the brightest stars in the National League this year and probably my favorite player to watch at the moment. I don't know if you saw last night, he managed to score from third on a pop-up caught by the second baseman in short right field after tripling, in addition to making yet another unbelievable throw from shortstop. So what have you seen from Tatis so far in this, barely half a season that he's had in the majors?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we throw around that phrase of, like, favorite player to watch a fair amount, I think. But I think he's the definition of it. Because when he's in the field, you have to be paying attention because he might throw a ball 94 miles an hour. And if he's on the base path, no matter what's happening, he might be finding a way to take an extra base and score. When he scored on that pop-up, I thought that was absolutely incredible. And it's like the third time this week that he's done something like that. He's been taking these extra bases on, you know, batted balls that you would not expect anyone to do that on, even if he's just taking third, but that one to score was really impressive. You mentioned the throw. He had a 94-mile-an-hour throw last night to get an out at first. That was the fastest throw by a shortstop tracked by StatCast this year. And he has four of the top five throws by shortstop. And the other one, which is number five, so he has the top four. Number five was Manny Machado playing shortstop, filling in while Tatis was hurt, which I just think is a cool thing for the Padres. And on all of these extra bases, he's been taking everything else. His sprint speed, so he has a 29.2 feet per second sprint speed. So 27 is league average, and 30 is considered elite. So he's just below that elite threshold, but he seems to be gaining. And he's had 12 bolts, which is something we track, which is a run with a 30-plus sprint speed. So basically, a run where you did have that elite sprint speed, even if you don't have it overall for the whole year. And he's had 12 of those, which certainly sounds like a lot. He's tied for the fifth fastest shortstop. You know, it's a very speedy position. You've got Trey Turner, you've got Mondesi, you've got Richie Martin, Ahmed Rosario even, but he's right up there with them. And he's just having so much fun with it. And it's so much fun to watch. I find myself, like, smiling watching him, you know?
Yeah, so he's incredibly infectious to watch. And I think one of the surprises to me, I'd always had him ranked highly as a prospect since he first, really since about the point when he got traded to the Padres and started to get scouted. The thing that has surprised me is he's even faster than I realized. He's at least a 7 runner on the 2-to-8 scale. He might be an 8. And I'd always known he could run, but he, especially when he was younger too, you've seen him you've seen the what he looks like physically, like the expectation was this guy could be huge, right? And he has one of his the players, if you ever talk to him, one of the players he models himself after is Manny Machado, who has worked to not get too big, right? The emphasis has been if you want to be able to be an elite defensive infielder, you can't get too big. And so far, it seems like Tatis is doing that, and that's allowing him to run at this really exceptional rate. Speaking of big players, let's talk a little bit about Josh Bell coming off that three-homer night last night. Bell was someone I'd always projected to hit for power, but he just never did it until this season. And it seems like, one, it seems like Josh Bell has certainly found a new gear. And I don't know, just anecdotally, it seems like the Pirates are a different club offensively this year.
Yeah, you know, he's just been so much fun to watch. He hadn't even had a multi-homer game in his career before this year, and now he has four, including a three-homer game, his first one last night. It was the first three-homer game by a Pirate since 2017, Andrew McCutchen. He was the youngest Pirate with a three-homer game since Andrew McCutchen in 2009. And I just think it's brought so much life to that team. He has 25 home runs before the break. His career high is 26 home runs in that rookie year, which he had a pretty good rookie year. He had a rookie year where, if not for Cody Bellinger, he would have gotten much more serious consideration. He had the type of year that we have seen win that award in the past when there hasn't been one overwhelming Cody Bellinger, I'm going to hit 45-plus home runs kind of year.
Right.
And he's one shy of that right now. So he has the third most home runs before the break in franchise history. The only player with more is Willie Stargell, who had 30 twice. So you never know. He just hit three, but we'll see if Josh Bell ends up at 30. But regardless, he's going to have at least the third most. I thought it was really fun last night that he hit three home runs. And in between home run two and three, he made an out against Daniel Descalzo. They were having a really hard time getting him out, and Daniel Descalzo comes in and gets him to hit a weak ground ball, and then he homers off of Craig Kimbrell. So I just think baseball, right?
Yes.
And on the Pirates overall, you know, it's interesting. I know that you mentioned they had a change entering the season, and it does feel like, I mean, especially with Brian Reynolds and, you know, Kevin Newman had that hit streak, it does feel like they've had maybe some more notable performances and everything. But I looked at a couple things. So their average exit velocity as a team is 87.6 miles an hour this year. It was 87.4 last year. So it's not really that changed, which I think is interesting because I thought that Bell and all that he's been doing might have brought it up, but it hasn't. And overall as a team, they're slugging about 30 points higher. Their hitting, just overall average, is up from, it's 268 this year, it was 254 last year, and on base is moderately up, you know, that kind of comes with everything else. But it does feel like they're a different team, and obviously their home runs are up, and we've seen that home runs are up across the league. But it's funny because I think entering the year, everyone was really focusing on that pitching and thinking that that pitching could really help them stay competitive in the NL Central. And it's the complete opposite that's happened. You know, the pitching has overall been a disappointment, and the offense has kept them afloat.
Reynolds, I'm glad you brought up Reynolds, too, because he came up the other day. Somebody asked why I didn't have Reynolds on. I did a piece last week, the top 25 Major League players under 25, and did not put Reynolds on there, despite the fact that he's, at least superficially, having a tremendous season. And one of the things I argue, because that's a piece I'm trying to look forward, at least, what are these guys going to be worth now going forward from this point? That, it was populated with a lot of younger players, of course. But Reynolds has right now a 437 BABIP, which immediately sets off alarm bells, right? There's just no way, no hitter can sustain that going forward. So I know you haven't done a deep dive on Reynolds necessarily, but when you see a player with that profile where he's producing, but you see something in there that is clearly unsustainable because no hitter can get a batting average on balls and play like that, can post that over a long enough period, you know, what sort of things would you look for then to dive deeper on a player like Reynolds to say, all right, well, how sustainable is any of this? What is the actual talent level or skill set below this stat line?
Yeah, so, you know, BABIP is always kind of a go-to there, right? And since I've, you know, started diving more into StatCast and all of that has become more available, one thing that I rely on a lot, and I think I've used here on the podcast with Buster a bunch, is expected stats. So we have expected batting average and expected slugging percentage and all of those, which are based on quality of contact. So they're essentially based on just launch angle exit velocity, and then, you know, strikeouts get factored in as well, especially for the batting average component. So his expected, he's hitting, what, 351 right now?
Yes.
But his expected batting average is 310. So obviously a difference there that's telling you that he's getting lucky to an extent. But it's also not an expected batting average of 250, which I sort of thought might be what I'd find here. He is making some pretty hard contact. He has a 90.6 average exit velocity. You know, we're talking about a pretty small sample still, but, you know, he has an expected slugging percentage of 452, and he's certainly not a 351 hitter, but he has a 47% hard hit rate. I mean, those things tend to not be as much of flukes, right? You may not be doing a lot with it, but if you're making hard contact, eventually that will help you in some way, most likely, and that's sort of what I'm seeing here.
One of the knocks on him as a as an amateur prospect at Vanderbilt, Buster's not here, we still have to get a Vanderbilt reference somewhere into the podcast, was that he struck out too much. And a little bit early in his pro career, certainly in the first year, first summer, he did strike out quite a bit. And then since then, he really cut the strikeouts, but he wasn't actually producing. It was as if, and this is totally me inferring something, I don't know if he was told this, but it was as if someone said to him, you need to not strike out so much. You need to not swing and miss so much. Be more aggressive early in the count. And he was doing that, not getting the result. And I wonder a little bit, because I actually do like Reynolds, just because I omitted him from the list doesn't mean I don't think he's good. I do think he's good. But just that, is this the happy medium for him? All right, you're striking out a little more now, but that's fine. We all live with strikeouts, but you're doing, from what you just described, he's producing enough quality contact. When he does put the ball in play, that's enough to make him a productive everyday player. And it sounds like I know you just took a quick glance at it, but it sounds like that's kind of where you've settled into.
Yeah. I think he, in a lot of ways, looks like a lot of young players. I'm just looking at what he's doing kind of against different pitch types, and he's, you know, raking against fastballs, and he's actually doing pretty well against the off-speed pitches, but breaking balls he's having trouble with, which is like, you know, most guys we see coming up, especially in the majors these days. So, you know, something to work on there. But I would say that, honestly, with how you set it up and everything, and with my own assessment, without having looked at the numbers before today, I sort of figured it was much more flash in the pan, but I would believe that he has the tools already to be pretty good, that he's not getting incredibly lucky.
Excellent. Well, this is out of character for me. We spoke about four different players and we were positive about all of them. So I appreciate you bringing a little sunshine into the podcast today.
I try. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. Also, I had one more thing I meant to say about Soroka. Can I say it?
Yes, absolutely.
I got so wrapped up in Soroka that I forgot to mention this great note, which I just think is worth making sure everyone's aware of. So he and Acuna both made the All-Star team. Obviously, Acuna will be starting for the National League. They're both under 22. And I thought this was absolutely incredible. Braves PR Jonathan Kerber told me this one before the game on Sunday night. The Braves are the first team since the inception of the All-Star game to have two players under the age of 22 on the All-Star roster in the same year. And I just think that's such a testament to letting these guys play at a young age and how great they've been, you know? But I think it's so cool. Yeah.
That is absolutely amazing. It's actually shocking to me that it has never happened before. But like you said, it's testament to players who are getting to the majors young, how good they've been, and two, to just letting the kids play.
Yeah, exactly. Let the kids play. And that's the final thing I'll leave you with, is that one of the most insightful things that Soroka said to us was that he has friends who are minor leaguers who aren't playing right now, and he's really grateful that, you know, his age wasn't an issue and that he's getting the chance to play. And he was sort of thanking the Braves organization for that. And, you know, that's not the simplest thing in the world, and we know that there are a lot of factors that go into those decisions. And, you know, I honestly don't even think he was alluding to service time stuff. Mm-hmm. I really think he was talking about being so young and not being overlooked for being so young. But I thought that was really cool that he said, you know, he mentioned Albies, and he mentioned Acuna, and he said, you know, I'm so glad that they're letting us play right now. So I thought that was awesome.
Absolutely. Well, this was great, Sarah. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Keith, we've got a few Bleacher Tweets here for you today. We're going to do two. The first one we're going to start off with comes from Jim Misner at Jim Misner 87, who asks, Hey, Keith, do you have any hidden gems as far as minor league fields go? Jim says personally that his favorites are Asheville and Idaho Falls. What say you, Keith?
Interesting, because I've never been to either of those. I'd love to get to Asheville. It's been on my wish list, my minor league wish list, just my travel wish list for a while. Personal favorites of mine, I love Greenville, South Carolina, the Greenville Drive, Red Sox affiliate, gorgeous ballpark in a really cute little town where the ballpark is right in the heart of things, too. I love any ballpark where you can walk out of the park and be in or very close to a downtown. Aberdeen, Maryland, the Aberdeen Ironbirds and the New York Penn League, I go there quite a bit. It's less than an hour from my house. It's a double-A quality ballpark that just happens to be in short season baseball, and great atmosphere, great environment. And again, to watch players, often really, like really great prospects. I saw the Astros first rounder there a couple of weeks ago in, you're seeing guys right out of college, maybe in their second year of pro ball, and seeing them in a double A caliber environment. And I have to mention, Reading, which I'm potentially going to tonight, actually, the Reading Fight and Fills. The ballpark is old. It's kind of charming, but it's certainly not nice in terms of like amenities or newness. But what a great atmosphere. I mean, that's just the old school town really supporting its minor league team. They always draw well. The fans are always into it. I'm always amazed. It doesn't matter whether the team's any good. The fan experience, the level of fan support there really stands out. Of all the minor league parks I've gone to, that always comes out at the top just for how much the locals seem to support their team.
Another tweet here comes from Montgomery Bop, great name right there, at MJBop24. He asks, and I know you're going to nerd out on this one, Keith, the Yankees have heard, quote, ridiculous asking prices for starting pitching. Do they have enough to land Marcus Stroman, or are they better off looking elsewhere? Buster has predicted a buyer's market. John Heyman says it's a seller's market. What say you, Keith?
I wonder if the Montgomery Bop, is that like the Blitzkrieg Bop? It feels like it's a – maybe I'm not up on the latest dance crazes. I tend to think it'll be a seller's market simply because – and by the way, Buster and John pay more attention to the details of that that side than I do. But my instinct says more of a seller's market because I just don't think there are that many good starting pitchers potentially available for trade, which would favor the sellers. To the specific question here, though, do the Yankees have enough in the farm system to land a significant starting pitcher? I think they do. I think it is more a question of what they might be willing to give up. Yankees have done a really great job the last 5 years or so in developing pitching prospects with trade value. It's not to say they're all necessarily great future big leaguers. They've done a really good job of helping guys in their system maximize their velocity and or increase spin rates on multiple pitches. So they've gotten some really great results from multiple guys in the lower levels of their system. Often Latin American signings, July 2nd guys who didn't even sign for a lot of money, but have turned out to be valuable pieces. Didi Garcia is their top prospect, in my opinion, and I think he'd be really valuable in trade. I just wonder if they'd say, we're not going to trade this guy. He's our number one. We're going to keep him because we see major league value. And then they would say, well, we'll trade anybody else below him. And they do have a number of guys, Luis Gil, Luis Medina, multiple guys like that at the lower levels of their system. Those are both pitchers with big arms. Could they trade in Everson Pereira, who's having kind of a not great year so far in short season? And Anthony Siegler, catcher who they just drafted a year ago, who's a really good defensive catcher with a chance to hit. Those guys were all so far away, though, it feels like the Yankees might say, yes, we'll trade guys like that who are 3 years from helping the major league team. If you'll take a package of those guys, we'll do that to go get a Stroman or somebody like that. And other teams might say yes. They might say we're willing to take long-term projects like that because they're good enough prospects that a collection of them still makes sense for us. So I think the Yankees could. It's just a question of whether they will.
Thanks for the tweets today, guys. Some really creative questions coming our way. Keep tweeting at Buster. He'll be back tomorrow. Keep tweeting at me, Troy_Farkas on Twitter. And as always, use the hashtag BleacherTweets.
Before we wrap up the show today, I just wanted to tell you about something really cool that's happening and how you can be a part of it. The Baseball Tonight podcast is offering the ultimate baseball experience that you've been dreaming about since you were a kid. You've now got a chance to experience the magic that is the Little League Baseball World Series in Williamsport. So let me tell you how. The Dream Williamsport Weekend Experience gives you and three guests the chance to get four tickets to the MLB Sunday Night Baseball game at the Little League World Series featuring the Chicago Cubs and the Pittsburgh Pirates on August 18th, 2019. A meet and greet with ESPN Sunday Night Baseball talent, including Alex Rodriguez, Jessica Mendoza, and Matt Vasgersian. You can sit in the seats next to the Sunday Night Baseball booth for one inning, get a meet and greet with current Chicago Cub and three times MLB All-Star Anthony Rizzo and former Cub and two-time World Series champion David Ross, get four tickets to the Little League Baseball World Series matchup on August 18th, 2019, a meet and greet with ESPN's Little League World Series talent, plus four museum passes, four media bags, four programs, four pins, and four caps. All you have to do is visit ebay.com/ESPN to bid on the Dream Williamsport weekend to donate to the V Foundation, where 100% of the proceeds will be used toward the ongoing fight against cancer. Because like Jimmy V once said, in the fight against cancer, we'll never give up. Thank you for listening to today's show. I'm Keith Law, and our producer today is Troy Farkas. You can find me on Twitter at Keith Law, on Facebook at Keith Law Writer. I did have a piece that went up this morning for ESPN Plus subscribers looking at the July 2nd free agents. So free agents signing from the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, Panama, just looking at the top handful with notes I got from talking to scouts about each of these prospects. Buster will be back tomorrow to fill you in on his time in London. But until then, have a great day, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.